things that made the modern economy, with Tim Harford.
There are two ways to tell this story. One of them describes that classic flash of inventive insight. In 1948, Joseph Woodland, a graduate student in Philadelphia, was pondering a challenge that had been thrown down by a local Philly retailer. Was there any way to speed up the process of checking out in his stores by automating the tedious process of recording the transaction? Woodland was a smart young man. He'd worked on the atomic bomb during the war. At the other end of the spectrum, he'd also designed an improved system for playing elevator music. But now he was stumped. On a visit to his parents down in Miami Beach, he sat and pondered and idly combed his fingers in a circle, letting the sand slide between his fingertips. But then, as he looked down at the ridges and furrows, a thought struck him. Just like Morse code used dots and dashes to convey a message, he could use thin lines and thick lines to encode information. A zebra-striped bullseye could describe a product and its price in a code that a machine might be able to read. The idea was workable, though with the technology of the time, it was costly. But as computers advanced and lasers were invented, it became more realistic. The striped scan system was independently rediscovered and refined several times over the years. In the 1950s, an engineer, David Collins, put thin and thick lines on railway cars so that they could be automatically read by a trackside scanner. In the early 1970s, an IBM engineer, George Laura, figured out that a rectangle would be more compact than Woodland's bullseye, and developed a system that used lasers and computers that were so quick they could process labelled beanbags being hurled over the scanner system. Joseph Woodland's seaside doodles had become a technological reality. But there's a second way to tell the story. It's just as important, but bear with me, because just for a moment, it's going to sound incredibly boring. In September 1969, members of the Administrative Systems Committee of the Grocery Manufacturers of America met with their opposite numbers from the National Association of Food Chains. The location? A motel. The Carousel Inn in Cincinnati. The topic was whether the food producers of the GMA could come to an agreement with the food retailers of the NAFC about an inter-industry product code. The GMA wanted an 11-digit code, which would encompass various labelling schemes they were already using. The NAFC wanted a shorter 7-digit code, which could be read by simpler and cheaper systems at the checkout. The GMA and the NAFC couldn't agree, and the meeting broke up in frustration. Years of careful diplomacy and innumerable committees, subcommittees, and ad hoc committees were required before finally the US grocery industry agreed upon a standard for the Universal Product Code, or UPC. Both stories come to fruition in June 1974 at the checkout counter of Marsh's supermarket in the town of Troy, Ohio, when a 31-year-old checkout assistant named Sharon Buchan scanned a 10-pack of 50 sticks of Wrigley's Juicy Fruit chewing gum across a laser scanner, automatically registering the price of 67 cents. The gum was sold. The barcode had been born. We tend to think of the barcode as a simple piece of cost-cutting technology. It helps supermarkets do their business more efficiently, and so it helps us to enjoy lower prices. But the barcode does more than that, which is why the second way of telling the story is as important as the first. The barcode changes the balance of power in the grocery industry. That's why all those committee meetings were necessary. It's why the food retailing industry was only able to agree in the end when the technical geeks on the committees were replaced by their bosses' bosses, the chief executives. The stakes were that high. Part of the difficulty was getting everyone to move forward on a system which didn't really work without a critical mass of adopters. It was expensive to install scanners. It was expensive to redesign packaging with barcodes. Bear in mind that Miller's beers were still printing labels for their bottles on a 1908 printing press. The retailers didn't want to install scanners until the manufacturers had put barcodes on their products. The manufacturers didn't want to put barcodes on their products until the retailers had installed enough scanners. But it also became apparent over time that the barcode was changing the tilt of the playing field in favour of a certain kind of retailer. For a small, family-run convenience store, the barcode scanner was an expensive solution to problems they didn't really have. But big-box supermarkets could spread the cost of the scanners across many more sales. They valued shorter lines at the checkout. They needed to keep track of inventory. With a manual checkout, a shop assistant might charge a customer for a product, then slip the cash into his or her pocket without registering the sale. With a barcode and scanner system, such behaviour looked pretty conspicuous. And in the 1970s, a time of high inflation in America, barcodes let supermarkets change the price of products by sticking a new price tag on the shelf rather than on each item. It's hardly surprising that as the barcode spread across retailing in the 1970s and 1980s, big box retailers also expanded. The scanner data underpinned customer databases and loyalty cards. By tracking and automating inventory, it made just-in-time deliveries more attractive and lowered the cost of having a wide variety of products. Shops in general and supermarkets in particular started to generalize, selling flowers, clothes, and electronic products. Running a huge, diversified, logistically complex operation was all so much easier in the world of the barcode. Perhaps the ultimate expression of that fact came in 1988, when the discount department store Walmart decided to start selling food. It's now the largest grocery chain in America, and by far the largest general retailer on the planet, about as large as its five closest rivals combined. Walmart was an early adopter of the barcode and has continued to invest in cutting-edge computer-driven logistics and inventory management. Walmart is now a major gateway between Chinese manufacturers and American consumers. Walmart's embrace of technology helped it grow to a vast scale, and its vast scale means it can send buyers to China and commission cheap products in bulk. From a Chinese manufacturer's perspective, you can justify setting up an entire production line for just one customer, as long as that customer is Walmart. Geeks rightly celebrate that moment of inspiration as Joseph Woodland languidly pulled his fingers through the sands of Miami Beach, or the perspiration of George Laura as he perfected the barcode as we know it. But the barcode isn't just a way to do business more efficiently. It also changes what kind of business can be efficient. The barcode is now such a symbol of the forces of impersonal global capitalism that it's spawned its own ironic protest. Since the 1980s, people have been registering their opposition to the man by getting themselves tattooed with a barcode. That countercultural fashion statement recognises something important. Yes, those distinctive black and white stripes are a neat little piece of engineering. But that neat little piece of engineering has changed how the world economy fits together.
The idea that the barcode really mattered came from the economist Emek Bosker. Our thanks to her. For a full list of our sources, please see bbcworldservice.com/50things.